right, and we're live. Today we have Jiho, my man. What's up, brother?
What's happening?
Not much, dude. So tell me a little bit about who you are. I know you're an insanely smart guy, so let's hear about it.
I guess I'll just do a quick intro. So I'm Jiho. I graduated from Yale. I played football there, and I'm currently working for GE as a product manager and analytics consultant.
Nice, dude. That's freaking awesome. So you went to Yale. Did you always want to go there, or how did that happen?
Surprisingly not. It was kind of a last minute thing, and I got to Yale because of football. And in high school, I loved playing football, but I was never really good at it. And I played defensive line, tight end, all these different positions. And senior year came the opportunity for me to switch positions, go into offensive line. And I ended up being pretty good at it. Nice. I didn't start until the sixth game of my senior year. And a lot, like throughout the season, I ended up getting offers from Ivy League schools, Purdue, Iowa, Air Force. You know, so it just came out of nowhere and was completely surprised. But that's my little Cinderella story. But before the recruiting process started, I told my coach I wanted to go somewhere that was academically elite. And it didn't matter as much how good the football was. I just wanted to provide myself better opportunities for the future and go somewhere that my parents could get behind.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense. So Iowa, you turned down?
Yeah, man.
I used to live there. That's a cool campus, cool spot. What about South Carolina? You weren't offered from them?
No. I think I just wasn't good enough to get on an SEC radar.
Ivy League of the South right there.
Yeah. So if it, in the middle of the high school senior season is pretty tough to get recruited, so it was pretty lucky I got those looks quick.
Yeah. I was about to say, especially now, it almost like freshmen and stuff are getting recruited, so like the last 6 months of senior year is kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wild. Our high school coach had a bunch of connections. He had a lot of, I guess, opportunities to get his name out there. He was the U.S. Army All-American high school head coach, the offensive coordinator for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So he had a good relationship with most coaches in the country.
Nice. You went in Georgia, right? In high school?
Yeah. So I went to North Gwinnett High School in Swanee, about 30, 40 minutes away from Atlanta.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's awesome. We got a few friends that went there. Yeah.
Yeah, good bit.
That's awesome. So Yale, you made that decision. Did you enjoy it there? Did you like it? How was the college experience, especially of playing football there?
Yeah, it was full of a lot of ups and downs. It started off kind of hot. So my freshman year, I was placed into this dorm situation. And if you don't know about Yale's residential college system, it's similar to Hogwarts, where they have the different houses, but we have colleges.
Yeah.
And you're placed into them either if you're a legacy or randomly placed.
Mm-hmm.
And has nothing to do with your field of study, but it's purely for living. So you'll have like the same dining hall, same facilities, and you share it with your colleagues.
Yeah.
But my freshman year, I had a crazy roommate situation. So my roommate was a bisexual Wiccan.
A what?
A Wiccan. So he's a witch that worships Wicca and like the three-horned god. And one time I came into my room and he was meditating in the middle of a pentagram with candles lit at each point. And like any college student, I took a Snapchat of it and just left, ran away. Nice. But you know,
you lived in the same room?
Yes. So he lived in the bunk above me, and he would bring other guys into the room and have them over because he was bisexual.
Yeah.
And me, being a pastor's kid, this was just a crazy way to get introduced to
absurdity
to Yale and all these different folks. But on the other side of my room were conservative Mexican from California, which is an anomaly.
Yeah.
And one of the more well-known gay kids in ROTC. So we just had a very clashing situation.
That's a diverse freaking room. And that was all in the same room? There's four people in it?
Yeah. So we had two rooms with the shared living space in between.
Dude, that's nuts. Yeah. That's freaking awesome, though. Yeah.
But it was a rocky start. I thought I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. Came in hot. It didn't work out for me. Mm-hmm. But then throughout the process, I was convinced I wanted to become an investment banker.
Yeah.
As one does at Yale. all of the football alum were investment bankers, so I kind of chose the path that was most lucrative and kind of what the world was telling me to do.
So is that what you finished? That was your degree?
I was an econ and math major.
Econ and math?
Yeah.
Dude, we need to talk about some econ stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize you were an econ major.
Yeah.
I thought it was computer science or something, but...
The track I was going towards was to get a PhD in econ. That's what that course was specialized for.
Dang, yeah.
But I didn't want anything to do with it.
Why not?
Well, I interned for the Alumni Fund my sophomore summer. And just like through different experiences, I realized that finance wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to be a part of making larger companies larger and rich people richer. I just didn't feel like that's what I was meant to do. It's not fulfilling to me. And I wanted to help people and you know, change the world. Maybe it was the Yale in me. Maybe it's the the high expectations that my parents set for me, but it wasn't going to be fulfilled through finance.
Gotcha. So no Wolf of Wall Street lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that.
Yeah. And then taking a couple steps back, freshman year, I played center on the football team.
Yeah.
I was recruited as a guard and then ended up playing center. But the biggest problem was I couldn't snap. So my identity
that's a big problem with being a center.
My identity was based off something I couldn't do.
Yeah.
And if you know our friend Rafe, I've snapped the ball over his head several times.
So you were the center when he was quarterback?
I guess through a couple of freshman games and just in practice.
Okay, gotcha.
Because I didn't start my freshman year.
Okay.
But the combination of those things made my Yale experience really tough at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I grew into my own and figured out what I wanted to do throughout the process.
Gotcha. So how was like life at Yale? Obviously, it's drastically different, I would assume, from Georgia and growing up there. Mm-hmm. So what was that change like?
So it was a pretty easy transition because I was on the football team.
Mm-hmm.
I had all these built-in friends.
True.
The rest of the athletes were my automatic friends, so that made it really easy to transition.
Yeah.
I think the biggest difference was how prepared and how driven everyone at Yale was.
Oh, yeah.
Because in high school, you're just living your own life, doing whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these students have a purpose and a trajectory that they've defined for themselves. And I had no idea what I was going to do. So it was very different.
Yeah.
In addition to just the difference in beliefs, like I was a Christian and going into it, most people that I know at Yale are either atheists or just not outspoken about their religious beliefs.
Interesting. So how was that? Like, how did you navigate? You were a Christian at the time at Yale. How did you navigate that? Or did you just not talk about it?
It would come up in conversations sometimes.
Yeah.
I was a part of Athletes in Action, which is a faith-based ministry group for athletes.
Okay.
So this was one way for me to be plugged in and hold myself accountable. But I think that during my college career, faith wasn't a huge priority until my senior year. I served as a freshman Bible study leader. And through Athletes in Action and my secret society, I was able to tell people my story.
Mm-hmm.
And during that process, I was able to be more introspective, learn more about myself, and really think about what my faith meant to me, along with a bunch of different things in my life.
Yeah. Nice. So would you recommend people to go to Yale? Like if somebody had the qualifications and they had a choice, say, between any Ivy League school, would you recommend the experience of going to Yale?
Absolutely. I think Yale is the best school in the world.
Besides the University of South Carolina?
A close second.
Yeah. Academically, at least.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Academics aside, it's just a really cool place. It's. I would hate to put Georgia Tech down, but it's not kids that are just good at studying, have a perfect score on their SATs, but they have substance to them. They have passion. They're really driven. And one of the defining factors of Yale is the residential college system, right? So you have a small family type feel within each of the colleges, and you have a more intimate relationship with those people. And so it gives a larger school a smaller community type feel.
Gotcha.
And then I spoke about Secret Society a little bit. So I was a member of Mason Chain. and secret society is essentially a place where your senior year you get to meet with 16 other people, 15 other people. It's 16 people in the group.
Yeah.
And you spend the entire year telling them your entire life story, all the formative moments and the reasons why you are who you are. And this can be told in a 2 to 8 hour bio. So you're telling people every single detail about your life. Most of your friends probably don't even know about.
Wait, so you're speaking for 2 to 8 hours?
Yeah.
About your life, essentially, mm-hmm. to a group of 15 people?
Yes.
Or 16 total?
Yeah, and most of them are going to be complete strangers. And so there's a long history with the societies, and every year they select 16 new seniors to join them. Most of the time, each of the delegates have like a representative or like a tap line legacy that they want to continue.
Yeah.
So for me, I was part of kind of the Yale football Deke tap line. And so we just wanted other people to hear from our perspective, mm-hmm. especially when other members of the society were editor-in-chief of the newspaper, president of Black students at Yale, members of the LGBTQ community. And these are folks that I would never interact with otherwise,
yeah.
and maybe didn't quite understand when different social issues arise. I just couldn't comprehend what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout this process, throughout getting to know them better, I started seeing them as human beings and learning to love who they are, because I realized they have the same struggles and they're just like me.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would be a super cool thing to do, especially with, I feel like, strangers. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it would be more beneficial to do it that way, where it's 15 people from complete different walks of life, different places, bringing all of that together, as opposed to, I mean, it would be cool to do with friends too, but I think it would be a really cool experience to have a complete group of completely different people. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And what they taught me was that like intelligence can be derived from, you know, unlearning and really relearning from other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about how much you know, but just your ability to kind of change your perspective when you learn and hear from others.
Yeah.
Because most of my life, I've learned the most when I make big mistakes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But how can we prevent that from being the only way that we learn? You know, we hear from other people's mistakes.
Yeah, exactly.
So that taught me a lot.
Very quick way to learn. So what is the best thing that you took from that, or like what perspective that you have, what changed?
I'd say getting to know someone and hearing their story make you fall in love with a person. Most of the time, yeah. when you don't like a people group or just a group of individuals that you've never interacted with before, it's mm-hmm. because you know them as the label.
Yeah.
And maybe their stereotypes. But once you get to hear from their side, you realize they have a reason
mm-hmm.
for thinking those beliefs.
Yeah.
Even though they may conflict with yours.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you grow an appreciation for people, for who they are.
Yeah, for just different walks of life and stuff. That's awesome. So I guess that leads straight into, we have it labeled as the Asian experience. And so your parents immigrated, how old were they? It was your parents that immigrated here and then you were born in America?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So how old were they whenever they moved here?
I can't really do the math right now that quickly, but my parents moved to America maybe 2 years before I was born.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Okay, cool. So what is that? What's the Asian experience? I mean, what is that like in America? What are your thoughts on it? Because I'm obviously unaware. As a white man, I obviously don't have much firsthand experience of the Asian experience. So.
Yeah, I had a very unique experience.
How so?
So I'd say growing up in Georgia, I think there was a keen awareness of Black racism, I would say like Latino racism,
mm-hmm.
But I felt like when I was a kid, I had been discriminated against, been called racial slurs, like Panda or Jackie Chan and other types of things.
Yeah.
And it was just...
Did somebody actually call you Panda?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just accepted, you know, people thought it was okay to do, that it was just a joke. Don't worry, I'm not being serious.
Yeah.
And so that was really tough to experience. And I think until last year with all of the Asian hate that was going on in the world, it wasn't really brought to light.
Yeah.
And so that type of racism wasn't held to the same standard mm-hmm. that I saw with other types of racism. So that kind of was a struggle for me growing up.
Yeah.
So
why don't you think it was held to a either similar standard, or why do you think it was held to a lower standard than any other forms of racism?
Mm-hmm. I think it's because Asians haven't been oppressed as much as the other groups have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in Black racism, there's a lot of historical slavery, for example, is a lot of the reason why.
Yeah.
And so, like, Blacks are heavily disadvantaged in the American system, which I totally agree with.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we wanted to correct. And so it's kind of a prioritization, I would say, in a sense.
Gotcha.
So
it was just kind of overlooked almost, or
I think so. It just wasn't the priority. It wasn't the focus.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, like, in my mind that, you know, one group deserves to be like thought about more than the other, mm-hmm. but it's just when I grew up, it wasn't as important as it is today.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's crazy because was that last year where it was basically right in our back door, wasn't mm-hmm. it? What was it? The massage parlors or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. Because that's kind of when it either like started, or that might have been in the middle of it. I'm not mm-hmm. too sure.
Yeah. Along with a couple other events that happened in California. Okay. So it was just a bunch of Asian related hate going on.
That's right. Because they were all within like a month of each other or something. I remember that. But that's crazy. I'm glad there's attention to it now, and I feel like some form of education around it, because in my opinion all racism essentially stems from the ignorance of people.
Sure.
I mean, education I feel like is the solution to racism, and learning people's stories. Like, if you have a conversation like this and understand that, hey, the large majority of Asians don't like being called Panda or Jackie Chan, well, if everybody understands that, then people probably won't say that anymore. And like, there's just growth that comes out of that. So I think that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Through our conversations, people grow.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what that, what is that called? Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. It's exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
You should write an Asian version of it.
Well, I'll read this version.
Yeah. Read this version and then write an Asian version. That's what I want to, push you to do. That would be really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, because that's an interesting one. It's really cool. So I guess we can move to work. You work at GE Healthcare.
Yeah,
is that right? Okay, cool. What do you do there?
So I'm a product manager.
Okay.
And I work with hospitals to come up with ideas for applications.
Mm-hmm.
And it's typically decision making software that helps nurses, doctors, case managers, and anyone in the hospital make decisions that are data-backed and identify the most important things that need to be done for the patient.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And okay. I work with a team of engineers to build that and make it a customer-facing app.
Gotcha. Nice. So you're basically a product manager of is it one app or is it several different ones? Or do you move from different project to different project?
I would say the latter.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is multiple, but our biggest platform is Patient Manager,
mm-hmm.
and that's where most of our work is being done right now.
Okay. Gotcha. Do you enjoy it?
It's great. I get to face new problems every single day.
Yeah.
I get to be creative and just like learn about healthcare and help people on mm-hmm. a large scale.
Yeah.
So I feel like it checks a lot of the boxes that I'm looking for.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's cool that you do something that's more fulfilling than, say, if you went down the, at least to you, more fulfilling than if you went down like the Wall Street walk. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That you noticed what you cared about, what you want, like what your passion was, and went after that as opposed to chasing the dollar.
I'm quite lucky that I was able to find it.
Yeah. That's cool. So you're in healthcare a lot. Let's jump to COVID and what's been your view of that? Because obviously you've been closer than I would say most people, in a sense, like you're kind of firsthand since you're within healthcare and like you talk to these people fairly regularly. I mean, what's your thoughts on it from even just the beginning, like start in whatever March of 2020? And because you were working there then?
Yes.
Yeah. So you've been there from the beginning. So what's your take from the beginning of COVID?
I'd say it's really interesting to see the progression of COVID and just see people react to it, see the science behind it continually change.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because, you know, recently the CDC has released that now you only have to quarantine for 5 days after the onset of symptoms, and people are poking fun at it, saying CDC is saying, oh, like we don't care about it, we can just change the standards overnight.
Yeah.
But what people need to realize is this is a completely new virus, right?
Yeah.
And that we're learning new things about it every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, you're not going to get it perfectly right the first time. You don't have enough data. The sample size isn't large enough for you to understand all the implications.
Sure.
But it's been cool to see things change over time. But I think the biggest thing is like the politicization of COVID.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah.
And so that's been a wild ride to see.
Yeah. So how much influence do you think politics has had on either the decisions that are being made or how we've handled it? I mean, obviously it's been impactful in some way, shape, or form. How much do you think politics has in making the decisions of these type of things? Like, say, making it from 10-day quarantine to 5 days, or wearing masks, not wearing masks, taking vaccines, not taking vaccines. Like, how much impact do you think politics has on all of that?
Well, I think it's a ton. I think especially during the beginning of quarantine when COVID was the worst.
Yeah,
people wanted to get back to work because they valued their money, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a big dividing factor. A lot of people on the left were focused on people's safety, whereas the right were worried about the individual person's perspective. Like, mm-hmm. How am I going to be able to feed my family? How do I keep my business afloat?
Yeah.
And so these are all kind of related to, I guess, economics and also just like policy in general. So there was an immediate split between the left and the right throughout all of COVID.
Yeah, which I think is still there. I think is, it's crazy because it's exactly that. It's one, do you prioritize the health and well-being of people or do you prioritize business? Yeah. And I think it almost every time came down to a person's perspective. Like if you owned a business and you were healthy, you were probably more prone to be on that side of, no, we don't need to be locked down. And then like flip, if you were 80 years old and had 4 or 5 comorbidities, it was a real threat. So then you're like, well, screw that person with the business. It's okay. Like, I think that's what kind of divided people.
Yeah. It was interesting to see the different reactions. So United States, for example, probably had the least strict mandates and reaction to COVID, where all across the world, a lot of places aren't even open.
Mm-hmm.
And have never been open because of COVID. So
yeah.
You're totally right. It's just different value systems.
Yeah, which it's interesting because the CDC actually has, I was looking at it the other day, they have a graph that takes into several different data points that they bring in. And it's basically a number 0 out of 100 of how strict a country is. Mm-hmm. And we're really kind of middle of the road. Like if you were to compare us to like China or something, like I think they were like a 75 or 80 and we were like a 50. But like if you took us, the UK, New Zealand, Australia, like these countries that are very, I would say similar, even Canada, that are similar to us, they were all fairly similar in a way. Like, I think the news has blown different countries up. Like, Australia looks like it's burning to the ground right now. And the U.S. probably looks like that to Australia. So, it's kind of interesting. Just, I think the politics in the news has been just absurd with that.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, somewhat blowing it out of proportion.
I think the one example that comes to mind is in the U.K., people are getting arrested because they broke their quarantine, right? Like the cops will come find them.
Yeah, it's in Australia too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you see in Korea, they have contact tracing on their phones, and they give you scheduled calls and unscheduled calls to make sure that you're quarantining in the place that you've identified and reported to the government. But just the stark comparison between the U.S., because we've had the stay at home.
Yeah.
A lot of people can leave their house and there are no consequences for it. So just the standards are so different.
Which was very short, though. I mean, at least in Georgia. I mean, we had, a lockdown for a month, maybe. And that was, semi-main. Like, I don't know if we ever even had, a mandatory, you can't leave your house. Mm-hmm. It got stricter at times. I mean, compared to these other countries, is nowhere near. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference is the mentality of, the group of people that are in the country. Like, I think if you were to do, try to impose something where, that strict, where, if you leave your house, you're going to jail. Like, if you did that in America, I think we would have an absolute uproar. Like, this country would flip upside down.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the difference. I don't know.
Well, to that point, people are told to get the vaccine. They freak out. So just imagine how they would feel if they're told to stay at home.
Dude.
And they had to.
I would not even want to imagine what would happen. I mean, we would literally probably have just a war against the government.
Yeah.
Before that happened, mm-hmm. we probably would. That would be insane. And then, I mean, that leads to vaccines. So, vaccines in general, do you think good, bad, indifferent? Where do you stand with those?
I think everyone should have the vaccine.
That's willing and able, or at least doesn't affect their health, obviously. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just don't quite understand why people are so against it.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't get it. I understand, I've heard all these different arguments against it, but I just feel like we need to be taking it to protect those around us.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that not everyone's going to agree with that. And the most recent development with Omicron is at least making me feel better, because the efficacy of COVID is going down. It's not as harsh. The symptoms aren't as bad, because the virus is trying to continue to, continue to stay alive, spread.
So it's continuing to mutate. Do you think Omicron being, it's clearly less severe than Delta was.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because of the vaccine, or do you think it's just a mutated version that just happened to be less?
I think it's just the properties of a vaccine, or of a virus.
Of the virus, yeah.
Yeah, so it's continuing to mutate because it wants to become more contagious, so because the virus's mission is to stay alive and spread to as many hosts as possible.
Yeah.
And so you do that, and it becomes less powerful, but it's more contagious. And so at least that part is making me feel better.
Yeah.
That not everyone is vaccinated at the levels that I would like.
Gotcha. Yeah, because that's a whole interesting thing. I mean, I get both sides of it. I'm personally kind of on the side of a libertarian standpoint of do whatever you want. I don't think there should be a mandate, and I don't think a person should be forced to. I think encouraging people to is fine. I think mainly just my issue is with pharmaceutical industry in general. It's so freaking shady, and there's so many deals and so much money that's being passed around and stuff. It's to me, can you trust it? Do you trust the pharmaceutical companies that go through lawsuits every year almost on just promoting drugs? And then, I mean, you look at Pfizer, and the CEO's coming out, we've made $37 billion this year, just on the vaccine so far.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks later, they're like, well, got to get your third booster. And it's all of it is kind of a little too convenient for them. I mean, I don't know. I'm back and forth on vaccines in general. I just think personally we should have taken a route of prevention of actually once somebody got COVID, hey, here's what you need to take once you get it, or some preventative measures go work out, take vitamin C, D. None of those things were mentioned at all. It was just vaccine. They put all of their marbles into vaccine, which I think was kind of crazy. I think it was a tool that could have been used, but I don't think it was I still don't think it is the end-all be-all to curing it.
And I feel I'm on the side that it was one of the only solutions. because when you bring health, I know Braden mentioned this in his his podcast episode. And I do agree, if you are healthy, if you're not obese, you're less likely to have comorbidities and less likely to die from having COVID, right?
Sure.
But in the midst of a global pandemic, we're not working to have people change their entire lifestyles like in the span of a month so that they're healthier and they're less likely to have adverse effects from having COVID, you know? And so it's a big global problem, and obesity is a huge problem that people have trying to solve, and America's tried to solve for a very long time, but clearly it's not going to be fixed overnight. So I just don't think that's the messaging that's required to overcome this pandemic.
Yeah.
I do agree that healthier people are better off.
Absolutely.
But it's just kind of yelling at people to lose weight or become healthier when it's more complicated than that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I do see the point of, I mean, exactly your point. I mean, if you're 100 pounds overweight and you have diabetes and whatever other comorbidities, I mean, you can't just say, oh, well, you got 1 month and you need to be healthy. Like, you need to lose that 100 pounds. You need to do all these things within a month. Like, I understand that. I do think it was a wake-up call to people that are, say, overweight or not healthy in general. I do think it was somewhat, at least I also hope, that it was a wake-up call. I do wish they would have pushed it a little bit more, because it's not necessarily you need to lose that 100 pounds. It's more so get active. Make sure you're eating somewhat like nutritious food. Make sure you are getting vitamins. Like, all of these things that I think, at least I guess down the road at this point, could help. I mean, at this point, we've had 2 years, and that's plenty of time. If I just think that if they were pushing that from the beginning, like, say they said, okay, everybody needs to take this vaccine as soon as we had it, which has been a year. But before then, what were your alternatives? Sit on your couch and wait on a vaccine? Like, if you were running outside or at a gym or something for that whole year, and then the vaccine came out, you got the vaccine, and then a year from then, you were able to work out again. Like, at this stage, like, there is no excuse. Except on, I guess, the individual person's choices.
And I think that were to make sense if the only people dying were the obese folks. So
yeah, and I mean, I'm talking large percentage. I mean, the large, large, probably, what is it, 80% or so are either multiple comorbidities or over like 80 years old.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a very, very small percentage. And I think that's where people have the problem. It's like, at least to me, the more you look into the data, the more I always correlate it to like just other things. It's like me or you dying from COVID, we are far more likely to get in a car wreck. So why on earth would we ever go get in a vehicle if we were more scared of COVID? Like, why would you ever drive?
Interesting. I guess my immediate response to that is it's not a circumstance where it only affects you, it affects other people.
But the same case is for driving. Like, say I went and was drinking and drove home drunk and got in a wreck, that affects somebody else. Or if I just got in a wreck with somebody in general, that does affect somebody else. It's that driving is probably, to me, the most similar kind of correlation to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, you do have a risk. Nobody even acknowledges it, though. And, like, it's crazy to me because it's, like, I heard a guy ask the other day where he was like, would anybody know about COVID if we didn't have a news channel or we didn't have social media? Like, in your day-to-day life, would you have any clue that it was even happening? Like, throw this virus back into 1850. Would anybody even know that there's a virus spreading?
China would.
Yeah, facts. Yeah, exactly. So outside of China.
Yeah.
But, like, to me, that's almost kind of crazy because it's not to say that it's not severe and it's not affecting people. It's just to say that it's insane how much the news pushes it, both sides of where they're just pummeling it every day. It doesn't matter what's pushed. Like, it's insane. But, all right, let's move from COVID. But they did, actually, they did push today, the Supreme Court voted on the OSHA vaccine mandates, and they did shoot that down. So that, except for healthcare workers, which I don't really understand. I feel like part of me is like, if it were okay for one, like, why wouldn't it be okay for the other? Or if it was not okay for one, why would it not be okay for the other? But I think I kind of see the implications to have it in healthcare. I think they're kind of similar to like military, where you have to get certain, like they have to get flu shots. Mm-hmm. They have to get like certain thing that's just part of it. So like it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting. That was probably what, 2 or 3 hours ago that went shooting. So
yeah. And I guess when you compare it to different vaccinations, like the flu, I think it makes sense, because I feel like COVID is headed towards the direction of the flu, because at one point the flu was killing off, you know, tons of people.
Yeah.
And as the virus becomes weaker, maybe we have a similar situation to that. So
yeah,
you'd be getting your COVID vaccine every 6 months and that type of deal.
Yeah, I mean that, which I guess, because the flu wasn't like completely like crazy deadly for the last 100 years. I mean, there are people that die from it, obviously, but it's not like insane numbers or anything.
But I'd imagine if I had the numbers in front of me, the beginning of the flu and that initial pandemic is probably similar.
No, like if, absolutely. I mean, it was definitely high and then it kind of faded off, and it looks like COVID's doing that similar thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's so interesting to me because it literally never even crossed my mind ever in my lifetime before COVID to ever get a flu shot. Like, I have never had one in my entire life to this day.
Wow.
And, like, I don't know why, though. It's not that I was against them. I was just like, well, I've never had the flu. Never had a flu shot. It's like, it just wasn't relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just crazy how, like, in 2 years, this one vaccine is just like, you have to get, like, you got to do this. Like, it's crazy. It's just intense. I'm just like, well, because it's still kind of the similar thing where it's like, when I had COVID, it was like 2 days of a headache, and I'm like, okay, well, I feel like I'm fairly safe from it.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? But it's obviously different for a bunch of people, because what, you've had it, what, once, twice?
I've had COVID twice, and
was it bad both times?
It was not bad. It wasn't bad either of the times.
Yeah.
I think my initial reactions to the vaccine were worse, but.
So the vaccine was worse than the actual COVID?
For a day.
Wow. Mm-hmm. See, that's what was strange. The vaccine for me was nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally worked out the same day I got it, both times. The second one, I went straight to the Virgin Islands the next day.
Yeah.
And I mean, it felt like somebody punched me in the arm.
Yeah.
But, like, I had no, like, mm-hmm. fever symptoms. I mean, like, I've heard some people that got fevers and, like, were really sick for a day or two.
But I had bad body aches, but
yeah.
I think that really helped, because I got the booster and then I ended up contracting COVID again, but I barely had any symptoms. So I think that was the vaccine at work.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, let's jump from COVID into some gun control. What are your thoughts on guns in general, specifically in America? Should they be legal? Should they not? What's your stance on just guns in general?
So I think guns should not be available to the general public.
In any capacity.
That they should be reserved for the military.
In any capacity at all.
Yeah. So not for sport, not for any use, because I view them as a killing tool. And, you know, with these mass shootings that we see with mentally ill people across the country,
mm-hmm.
I understand that the mental illness is the issue, and that's what initiated that event. But I don't think they would be able to kill people to the extent that they did without the guns. You know?
So they could kill less. And so I guess my argument with that, or my misunderstanding maybe, is it seems like you're punishing thousands upon thousands of people for one idiot who makes just a stupid mistake that no one else had any like say in or doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just ruins it for everybody. I mean, it would almost be like if there was a guy that went running through the streets and was hitting everybody in the head with a golf club. And they said, well, shit, since somebody had a mass murdering with a golf club, golf is canceled. You can no longer buy clubs anymore. Like, to me, that doesn't make sense. And so it also doesn't with a gun, just because a gun is useless without a person using it. Similar to a golf club, a knife, or any other kind of weapon.
Sure.
One can be used potentially to kill more faster, like clearly. Mm-hmm. You can kill people quicker with a gun, obviously. Yep. But that's the only difference I see.
Yeah. And I see where you're coming from. But when you bring the school example, if someone shows up with a gun, they could kill 10 plus, maybe 100. But mm-hmm. if there are adults, other people around on the scene, they might end up injuring a couple, but, you know, might be stopped at 1, 2, you know, and doesn't reach the 10 plus number up to 100.
Yeah.
Because someone with a knife, you can probably, if three people attack them, they probably could have stopped someone with a knife pretty mm-hmm. immediately.
Yeah.
And additionally, I guess my view with the guns, I lost my train of thought there.
I don't know. I guess I would go mainly to like sporting, like just hunting in general.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So to, I just remembered okay. to address your point earlier, you're kind of punishing the rest of the country. So what I'm saying is I value the safety, and taking away the ability to kill tons, mm-hmm. Is more important than the enjoyment and the entertainment that people get. Cause at this point in life, people aren't using guns for sustenance and hunting, to feed themselves. It's more for sport.
Yeah.
And so that's my justification there. It's more important to save these people's lives than for you to have fun in your backyard or in the woods.
Yeah. I don't know. I definitely, like, I don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. Mainly because we've had guns a long time. Mm-hmm. Long time. We haven't had mass shootings for a long time. And so I personally think it's less of the guns. It's more of the health and well-being of mentally of the people in our society. I think that has far more to do with it than any kind of gun. Because, I mean, you could put a freaking bazooka in my room and it wouldn't matter. Like, I'm not going to go shoot up a school or something. And so that's just where I stand on it. I think that there's more things that contribute to it as opposed to if you were to just take away guns. Because the issue is, if you take away all guns, criminals and people who are going to shoot up a school are still going to get guns, similar to how they still get drugs or any other things that are illegal. There's still many ways to get things that are on the black market. So I think if you had a society, like imagine if we abolished all guns tomorrow and we had a society where you knew nobody had a gun. How easy would it be for me to then go buy a gun on the black market and literally shoot up everything I even wanted because I know nobody has a gun.
Yeah. And I think that makes it tougher for the impulsive gun user. And so a lot of these cases, they could have gotten the gun from their parents' gun safe, or they just went up to the store and picked up the gun, and it was just as easy as that. And so yeah. That would be moving more towards like organized crime. So like crime groups, you know, gangs, people that are kind of intentionally committing crime on a regular basis. Those would be the ones that would, you know, attain the guns through those black market and illegal channels. But it doesn't make it easy for the general public or the, you know, Joe Schmo mental illness kid to just pick up a gun.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I just think, well, I know.
Well, it's tough because this is something that we've had for a long time.
The problem is implementing it.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, if our government came out tomorrow and said, no more guns, mm-hmm. you have to return all of your guns to the government. Dude, it would be an all-out freaking war. I mean, even me personally, there's not a chance in hell I'd give my guns to him. No chance. Zero. And I think a lot of people in America share that view. Mm-hmm. So I just don't... One, I don't agree with it, but two, I don't think it's practical.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it can be done. Even if they put it into policy.
With Korea, Japan, different countries where it's illegal for, you know, civilians to have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have gun recalls. They later on implement fines for anyone that has a gun
yeah.
in their possession. I think in certain countries they have it to where you can have guns for sport, but it's stored at the local police station when you're not using it. So like these like additional measures. So no one actually has a gun in their possession unless if they like have.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you have to store it at like a storage unit or something. That's for a vault.
But I think I've seen the gun recalls happen in other countries. I just don't know that it would be that different in America. I just don't know how special America is or how different their circumstances, but I've seen it done in other places. And of course, it's not an overnight solution.
No, for sure. I'm sure that takes time. I'll have to look into, what did you say? It's Korea and where? Japan. That have done that. I need to look at it and what their laws were before, of if they were already strict. Because in the large majority, like we have, I believe it's around 20 states that are constitutional carry, which means you can, if you're not a felon, you can just go buy a gun and carry it. And that's 20. So that's 20 out of 50 states. Mm-hmm. I mean, outside of like New York, California, Illinois, a handful of other states, we are extremely laxed. I mean, like on the far right side of guns, which is, it makes it, I personally think that it would never stand a chance of happening. I just don't know how it could, but
I think, well, you don't hear this from Democrats like mouths today. I think it's a little bit too radical because most people would be against it. I think even the left and the right both have sentiments that, okay, like some of these guns are for fun. Maybe it's so that one day if the government tries to, I don't know, take over, we can protect ourselves. So like there's a lot of different reasons why people have guns and why they continue to have them.
Yeah, which, I mean, that's part of the Second Amendment, is, and that's part of the point behind it.
Yes.
Is so that the government can't just overtake everyone. That it's so it gives basically a fair chance of the entire American people, essentially against our military at that point, because that's who the government would send. So, I mean, that was kind of the point behind it. It alleviates essentially turning into just like a monarchy.
And at this point, I feel like that argument is not valid. I just feel that the government, no matter how many guns the rest of the country has, will win out at the end. Because they have access to all of the technology, everything that is 30 years ahead of the time that the general public doesn't have access to. Yeah. And I just think that, one, if you believe in that, that's a lack of faith in humanity. And then, two, I just don't think it's realistic.
For what, us fighting the military?
Yeah, for that scenario to ever come up.
No,
in a developed country like America, like maybe where it's corrupt in a third world country.
I mean, it definitely happens in the world. But for, I just don't know how that would work.
That would be crazy.
I mean, because it's one of those like, okay, sure, the military could win. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, they're not just going to drop a bomb on all of America and just blow everybody up. I mean, clearly they could just do that. But what, at that point, what do you have? Your country's gone. That's the problem, is there's essentially, like, there's a part where a country is nothing without the people. Like, you can't produce products, you can't have jobs, you can't, nothing happens. So, like, there's a point where, like, they have to keep the people, but then what do they do? Like, if all of America just surrounded, like, the biggest bases in America, and then, like, the White House and stuff, and we just attacked it or something because we weren't giving up our guns and it turned into an all-out war. Mm-hmm. Like, what do they do? It would almost, at that point, it would almost have to be ground force against ground force.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have tanks and stuff, obviously. Like, I think they would definitely have the upper hand, but we would have far more people. Because like you said, I think the left and right would, majority, say 80 to 90% of Americans would agree not to 110% do away with guns, I would think.
And I think the only way you could entertain the idea that this would ever happen is that our government fails, like checks and balances allows this to happen, that a dictator comes in and
we would have
something
to go
that everyone doesn't believe in.
Yeah.
So I just feel like it's a nonsensical scenario.
We would have to go under. Well, I don't think us going under is nonsensical at all.
But it's just escalating to the point where it would become the general public against the government.
I think that would just be a piece of it, though. Mm-hmm. Because there's obviously chaos. Like, that's a part of the cycle. Like, you run out of money, you have crazy inflation, your dollar's worth nothing, the government basically crumbles, there's some form of a...
Sounds like a movie.
There's some form of a rearrangement, which is usually either a civil war or some form of realignment of who's in power. And then you kind of start back over at, we're restarting a new country.
Yeah. I didn't think we'd be talking about these types of scenarios in this podcast, but here we are.
Here we go. I like to go down rabbit holes. I've already been down a couple rabbit holes today that were absolutely crazy. But, what time is it? How long have we been rolling? What is it, 6:20? What time did you get here? Oh, it's been an hour and 20 minutes already?
About an hour, I guess.
What the heck? Cool. So let's wrap up fairly quickly. I have one thing that I definitely want to touch on. So one thing that I've noticed about you is that you have an insane drive to always improve no matter what it is, whether it's fitness, learning, like anything in your life, you always want to get better. So I just wanted to ask, like, how did you develop that, or like, where did it come from? And I guess what tips would you give to somebody of like, how can they improve that?
Well, I think the reason why I am who I am is because of the way I was raised. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was the best thing, but I grew up in a pretty strict household with the traditional tiger parenting methods. Yeah. So I would have to study all the time. If I was watching TV, I wasn't doing good enough. I need to be reading books instead. You know, an A minus isn't good enough. You need 100. And so just that mentality that I have to be perfect. Yeah. And then even if I was really good, I was never good enough, kind of drove me to work even harder. So that was one part of it. And then the other aspect was having parents that didn't speak English very well. Mm-hmm. So I was a self-starter. Whenever I struggled with school, I had to figure out how to fix things or get better.
Gotcha.
And yeah. So like a lot of things with paying the bills, or my parents like getting letters from the government or different companies, like I would have to like do those things. And so I learned to be very self-sufficient and realize like I control my own destiny. I like determine my outcome.
Yeah.
And so even with football, like I realized that I needed to work really hard. Like I wasn't going to have other people help me out.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. No, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to somebody to like develop that besides getting Korean parents? Well, that might be your challenge.
highly recommend, because it's been very effective.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people do a poor job of the goal setting process.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll want to achieve a goal, they want to get somewhere, but they don't take the actionable steps to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Or come up with a plan. Because yeah. If you say, I want to lose weight, you're probably not going to achieve that. So you want to figure out, like, what are you doing to lose weight? How often are you going to the gym? So coming up with a regimen, a routine that'll keep you accountable to your goal.
Yeah.
And I'm a person that's motivated by relationships and like working with others. So if my friends are doing that, then maybe that's like my plan. I have to do things with friends so I can achieve that goal.
Gotcha. Yeah. Just putting yourself in a place to basically set up for success.
Yeah. And another thing that I've realized is you want to set goals that have to do with the person that you want to become, not just arbitrary goals. Because
mm-hmm.
if it's something that you want to become, like you're going to understand the reasoning behind the work every single day, because you want to become that, not just because you named an arbitrary goal.
Gotcha. So is that where somebody should start? So one of my friends sent me, it was a 5-year plan. First, he texted me and he was like, hey, man, have you ever done a 5-year plan? And I was like, no, bro, I don't even know what I'm doing 5 days from now. And because when I think of like 5-year plan, I think business, where it's like, okay, we're forecasting like the dollars and stuff. But it was really interesting because he sent me like a paragraph, and it was essentially a letter to himself now from 5 years. So it's like, hey, like, hope you're doing well. I'm now 32. I'm working at such and such job. I have a kid. I do whatever. Like, it was going down this whole list of like, this is his life. Do you think that would be effective in order to start your goal planning? Because I feel like if you had that, then you just, you simply just got to create goals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought it was kind of cool.
I think in adulthood, it's hard to dream and figure out what you want to do in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Right. Because when you're younger, you want to be an astronaut, you want to be a firefighter, and you have these big aspirations. But when you're older, those dreams aren't quite as aspirational, right?
Yeah.
And so it's one, coming up with what your ultimate goal is.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this I'm speaking to is from Unique, which is a curriculum that I'm taking with Kyle Harrison, Avery's dad.
Yeah.
And it does very similar things. So like you, like one writes what you would want other people to say about you at your funeral, right? Like, what do you want people to take away from that? Who do you want to be there? Because those are the people that you care about the most.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like coming back to present time. So like next would be 5-year goal. What is the type of person you want to be in 5 years? And the thing is, most of the time those are kind of fluffy. You don't have, you know, concrete goals that you want to achieve by that. Maybe you do.
Yeah.
But then if you get to like 3 year, 1 year, you identify like different objectives that you want to accomplish short term. And then shorter, like 30-day, 90-day goals that'll help you reach those shorter term, and then like progressively help you become that person you want to be in 5 years. So it's nice to like set a trajectory, right? Like if you want to be an astronaut, you have to do like these things.
Yeah.
Like in 5 years, you want to do something in like 1 year, in the next 30 days. So making it actionable. And, but it's nice to have those like large aspirational goals. You just have to like create a system for you to be accountable.
You gotta
to
keep tearing it down. Yeah, that's kind of cool. I think I'm gonna do that. I think I'm gonna make like start at funeral, and then I'm gonna make the assumption that it's like 70 plus, whatever, and then I'll tear it back 20 years from now, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 3 years from now, 1 year from now, and then make like maybe monthly goals or something that strive to that. I might map that out. Might give it a shot. Is that what Unique does? Have you did that in that?
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
So it does it from a God perspective.
Yeah.
So like, what is my God dream? What steps do I need to take to make that possible? So that's essentially what we're doing throughout the course. And so you'll do things like come up with a bucket list, like things I want to accomplish in different categories of my life, like work, life, play, love. Large, like 25 things in each of those buckets. And then what I was telling you with the road mapping, like what I want to do in the next couple of years. So it's a pretty cool course.
Dude, I like it. I need to take that. I should have freaking done it this time.
Yeah, it's extremely practical. So if you have the opportunity, I would recommend it.
What's the time commitment?
So I've been doing it for a little bit less than a year now. We meet for hour to hour and a half sessions. I think we've met less than 20 times.
Okay, in a year. Yeah, that's not bad. Cool. Yeah, I might check it out.
Yeah.
So wrapping up, two final questions. The first one, what is the best thing you've bought on Amazon under $100?
Best thing on Amazon that I bought?
Besides an alarm clock that sprays water. That was Clayton's. He's got a freaking alarm clock. Yeah. He said that, I was like, what? That's funny.
Well, speaking of spraying water, I recently bought a bidet off of Amazon.
Oh my gosh. If that's your number one, I'm deleting this episode. Dude, we have one in the bathroom. Yeah. Dude, I did it one time, and I will never, ever do it again. It was the most... I literally, my head almost hit the freaking ceiling. I went shooting off that toilet.
Stream a little too strong?
Bro, I did not realize that that damn thing was going to be like a freaking rocket. Bro, it was not good. It was so bad.
Yeah. So this guy named Grant Piegler came to Wet Wednesday. You were there, but were you there?
No, I wasn't there.
Oh, yeah.
So, y'all were texting me. I was out of town, and y'all were texting me like, yeah, we all just bought bidets. I was like, what the hell's the matter with y'all?
So he was pitching it to us, and the most compelling argument was, if someone threw poop at you, like on your arm, on your face, anywhere in your body, you wouldn't just use paper to wipe off. You would use water and then something else to wipe off the water. And so why would we treat our butt any differently?
I know why, because it's a freaking jet stream that pegs you in the ass. That's why.
I think you may need to adjust the pressure.
Yeah, for sure. So bidet is your item?
Yeah.
Nice.
Bidet.
Final question. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Best advice? I've received a lot of good advice. What's yours? Tell me by time.
Best advice I've ever received, I would say probably keep it simple, stupid. Kiss. That's the first thing that came to mind, so I'll roll with that. I don't know if that's the best, but that's some advice I've gotten. Keep things simple.
I think for me, it's that you have control over your own destiny.
Yeah.
And just thinking from a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Because a fixed mindset those types of people believe that the world is against them, and the reason why they're suffering or in poor circumstances is because of the world, and that they can't do anything to change it.
Heck yeah.
But the growth perspective, that mindset tells you that you can change whatever you want. You can become who you want to be.
Yeah.
And if you're willing to do, like, one, have a positive attitude, and then two, make it practical, you can essentially achieve whatever you want.
Absolutely, dude. There's an abundance in the world. Mm-hmm. More than anyone could ever need, want, or desire.
Yeah.
That's good freaking advice.
Yeah. And I think some people, it's harder for them to understand, but I hope that everyone can take that and, you know, apply it there in their own lives at one point.
Heck yeah, dude. I hope so. So thanks for coming on, bro. I'm definitely going to have you again. Maybe I'm going to interview Rafe and then maybe have both of you.
I mean,
I want some Yale stories.
Well, we have plenty.
Heck yeah.
And if it went anything like this one did, that one's going to be wild time.
I love it. Awesome, bro. We are out.